evening, everyone. So for the three of you visiting, two of you who are seated right there, we've been going through Ecclesiastes through the year this year, just month by month, doing a chapter. There's 12 chapters of Ecclesiastes with the 12 months in the year. And a few of the members here last year mentioned that Ecclesiastes was their favorite book. And I realized I hadn't really taught on Ecclesiastes very much. And I thought as I read it last year, there were a lot of lessons I did not see there before and things that I thought would be very helpful for the church here to go through. And so since we're in chapter 3, it may be helpful just to mention a couple of things about the book as a whole. Ecclesiastes is a very different book than really any other book of the Bible, even of the wisdom literature. That would include Job, Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon. In Ecclesiastes, the preacher, who seems to be Solomon, really is looking for meaning under the sun, which is like looking for meaning in an atheistic way. If you're to take God out of the equation, you know, can you find fulfillments in life? Is there meaning in life? Is there substantial joy in life? And what Solomon ultimately finds in chapter 1 and chapter 2, very quickly, it doesn't seem like his endeavor to search that out was necessarily quick, but in terms of writing about that endeavor, within the first two chapters, Solomon establishes that everything is vanity. Any gladness you experience in this life, in chapter 2, verse 10 through 11, all of the gladness of this life is like a mirage. It fades. It's shallow. It's really not substantial. If you ask honest questions, if you investigate with wisdom, you realize that under the sun, really without God, you're left with nothing and even less than nothing. So look at chapter 2, verse 17. As Solomon kind of continued to think through this and he continued asking wise questions and investigating things honestly, he went from earlier in verse 10 and 11 having a sense of gladness in kind of the process of things that he was doing to look for meaning. When he realized how fleeting it was, how vain it was, verse 17, I hated life, and all the work that was done under the sun was grievous. Verse 18, thus I hated all the fruit of my labor. The very things that he had fleeting gladness in, how quickly that turned from having gladness in the moment to things just turning upside down. And it just continues on through that chapter. He does reach a conclusion at the end of chapter 2 that there is goodness and joy that can be had in life. But in verse 25 of chapter 2, he mentions that ultimately that can only be achieved with God and in acknowledgments of God. So chapter 3 is going to build on that. All right. With that, introducing chapter 3. Solomon has been writing from experience in chapter 1 and 2. Now he's writing from observation. And I want to point out some verses in chapter 3 and 4 that emphasize that. Look at chapter 3, verse 10. I have seen the endeavor which God has given the sons of men. Look at verse 16 of the same chapter. Furthermore, I have seen under the sun. And look at verse 22 in the same chapter. I have seen that nothing is better than that man should be glad in his work. Look at chapter 4, verse 1. Then I looked again at the acts of oppression under the sun. Look at verse 4. I have seen that every labor and every success of the work is a result of jealousy between a man and his neighbor. Look at verse 7. Then I looked again. And then verse 15. I have seen all the living. So Solomon went from experience. Here's what I've done. And here's what I can tell you from what I've done. And now in chapter 3, we're done with Solomon's personal endeavor. Now it's about wisdom from what he has seen and observed through wisdom. And so before we read chapter 3, there's a question I've been asking as we've looked at chapters 1 and 2. When does someone else's perspective have the power to change how you live your life? It's one thing to agree with someone else's perspective. It's one thing to see wisdom in someone else's perspective, appreciate someone else's perspective. But that's not Ecclesiastes, right? Like Solomon isn't writing about his observations or his experiences just so that we read the book and say, oh, that seems pretty wise, the conclusions he came to, or even to necessarily like intellectually agree. The book is meant to change how we live our lives as a result of the preacher's experiences and observations. And that leads us now to chapter 3. Chapter 3, verses 1 through 8. There is a time for everything, and there is a time for every delight. I'll kind of talk more about why I worded it that way here after reading. Chapter 3, 1 through 8 again. There is an appointed time for everything, and there is a time for every matter. The word there in some translations, instead of matter, it will say event. Some translations will say delight, because that word in other passages is used to convey something to be desired, or something that brings delight. So every matter or every delight under heaven, a time to give birth and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to uproot what is planted, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to tear down and a time to build up, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance, a time to throw stones and a time to gather stones, a time to embrace and a time to shun embracing, a time to search and a time to lose. Some translations will say a time to give up is lost, a time to keep and a time to throw away, a time to tear apart and a time to sew together, a time to be silent and a time to speak, a time to love and a time to hate, a time for war and a time for peace. So Solomon kind of gives a very complete picture, kind of the both transient nature of every season of life, but also a very complete picture of every kind of season of life. I think something we need to take away from this primarily is, you know, Ecclesiastes is conveying wisdom, wisdom to be applied, wisdom to change our lives. And so I think this section isn't just about, you know, how poetically beautiful it is that there's a time for everything, but rather that wisdom in how we live is rooted in properly navigating, even embracing, life's very diverse, very inevitable realities and seeing value in them all. So again, I already mentioned that in verse 1, the word for matter or event really in most other areas is translated something delightful, something to be desired. So again, it seems like the preacher isn't just saying that these are different things, but these are different good things. Look at verse 11 and what the preacher says in verse 11. He has made everything beautiful in its time. So, coming off of chapter 1 and 2, I think there's a reason for the structure of Ecclesiastes. Because Solomon now, the preacher, has closed a lot of doors on the purpose of life, the meaning of life. And what he's done is he's closed the doors that life isn't about doing something new that's never been done before. Life isn't about accumulation. There actually really isn't any real substantial satisfaction in accumulation of possessions, accumulation of experiences. There isn't fulfillment in achievement, of constantly doing more, doing better, getting to a higher position, right? Getting a better career, advancing your career. What Solomon has already closed the door on is that's not what life ultimately is about. And if you're to think with some wisdom about it, you would arrive at those same conclusions. So I think here's the point of why this is here after chapter 2. Meaning is already in life. Fulfillment is already in life. And it doesn't come from achievement or accumulation. It comes from accepting what reality is already. This chapter is going to come to a lot of conclusions pretty early on that Solomon is going to keep coming back to through the book. Like, for instance, in verse 14, it says at the end of the verse, God has so worked that men should fear him. That's a conclusion. The very end of the book, he'll say, the end of the matter when all has been heard is this: fear God, keep his commandments, for this is man's all. So again, chapter 3 does have some conclusiveness to it. And the idea that God has been deliberate, he's locked many things in. In chapter one, he already said some things are bent and God has designed them to never be straightened. Some things are empty and God has designed them to never get filled. That life is locked in. The human condition is locked in. And it's a little bit like grace. So I want to illustrate it with God's grace in a gospel context, right? God's grace is there. Jesus died. He rose from the dead. That happened, right? There's a sense where grace abounds in our lives when we obey the Lord, when we submit to the Lord, when we open our hands to the Lord. But I want you to think, does the way grace works with all of that, that grace abounds and we obey, we need to serve the Lord, does that mean we're earning God's grace? Or that God is giving us grace on the basis of achievement? And that we're accumulating by achievement? That's exactly how Solomon is describing life, right? That we don't earn meaning, we don't achieve meaning, it's already there, we just have to discover it, we need to interact with life and navigate life in the right way. And then lastly, it's impossible to appreciate life properly and its fulfillment if our perspective is pleasure-oriented, like Solomon's was in chapter 2, right? Where he accumulated possessions, wealth, servants, concubines, whatever, agriculture, animals. You know, Solomon ended up very frustrated at the end of chapter 2. Jesus said in Luke 8, verse 14, you don't need to turn there, but it's where he told the parable of the seed of the soil. Some seed fell on the thorny ground where, well, thorns grew up with the plant. It choked the seed from being able to bear any fruit. Here's what he said, that the thorns are the worries and the riches and the pleasures of this life. What Solomon is going to get to in chapter 3 is that life isn't about pleasure, because there's a lot of aspects in this list that don't feel good, right? Birth doesn't feel good, but I mean, birth is a very joyful thing. But death doesn't feel good at all. And death very often, although if you're a believer, there's joy in death, even still, there's a great sting to it. You know, a time to kill. Killing, I can't imagine, would ever feel good. Time to tear something down, uproot things, mourning, weeping. There's a lot of angles to this list where a part of the side of these coins that have these two sides is going to be more difficult. It's not going to be something that is pleasurable, right? But I want to kind of lead into this with that there's no negative aspects to this list. And that might sound strange. Again, they're two sides of the same coin. You know, verse 11, God has made everything beautiful in its time. Verse 1, there's a time for every delight under heaven. So there's really not a bad side. You may think, well, killing is the negative side, healing's the positive. Tearing down is the negative, building up is the positive. Weeping is the negative, laughing is the positive. Embracing is the positive, shunning embracing is the negative, etc., etc., etc. But I want to ask you this. Because something is hard or difficult, does that make it bad? Just because something is difficult, does that make it bad? I want you to think about this with Jesus and his life. Was the cross a bad thing? There's some senses where it was, where people in crucifying Jesus were certainly making a sinful decision. But did God show that the cross ultimately was something that was meant for good and to accomplish good? Think about it from Jesus' perspective as he endured the cross. Difficult? Yes. But was it bad for Jesus himself to endure the cross? Something else I've been pointing out in Ecclesiastes is it relates to the overall context of our relationship with God. So many things that we naturally think are bad, God actually says, well, those can be good. And if you just change your thinking, it's a good thing. And I've mentioned before, Jesus tells us to take up our cross. Okay, is the cross a good thing or a bad thing? Is suffering a good thing or a bad thing? Is dealing with persecution a good thing or a bad thing? Last week in our Bible class, we looked at Luke chapter 6, Jesus' sermon. He said, blessed are the poor. Is being poor a good thing or a bad thing? Blessed are those who mourn, good thing or bad thing? Blessed are those who hunger. Is being hungry a good thing or a bad thing? Again, so many things that we call bad, God says that actually can be a blessing and a good thing. So many things we naturally call good, God says, be careful, because that good thing can actually be a bad thing if you don't look at it the right way and navigate it the right way. Again, think about the cross. But I want you to think about Paul's example in Philippians. So he was writing from prison, and a big part of that letter is he's trying to convey to them that his circumstances that can be seen as limiting or as bad have actually served to make progress in the gospel. And it's interesting, while in prison, while he's trying to teach that in the first few chapters of Philippians, he concludes by saying, rejoice in the Lord always. Not just when things are easy, not just when it feels good. Learn to rejoice in every season. Learn to see beauty in every time. He goes on to say this in Philippians 4:11 through 13, that he's learned to be content in any circumstance. In any and every circumstance, he says, I have learned the secret, meaning this is something he had to learn. It was a discipline where he needed to deny himself, to seek understanding with it. The secret of being filled and going hungry, both of having abundance and suffering need. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. God has made everything beautiful in his time. We're the ones that, from our perspective, call bad what God says can be called good. We're the ones who call useless and unproductive things that God may say that actually could be productive and useful if you would just treat it or think about it differently. And so with this list, again, this is the reality of the different seasons of life. It's not that some things are bad and some are good. And so I think something else conveyed in this list is it's foolish to overreact to or overinvest in, neglect or outright reject any particular time, right? It's easy to take one while rejecting the other, right? I can enjoy laughing so much in verse 4 that I never learn the value of weeping. I can enjoy celebrating so much in verse 4 that I never learn how to mourn in a healthy way. I may enjoy planting in verse 2 so much that I don't understand the need to uproot what's planted, and on, right? So again, we may overinvest in life's convenient times and comfortable times to a point where we overreact when things become inconvenient, when unexpected tragedy hits us. Ecclesiastes is saying that tragedy is a reality. Inconveniences are a part of life. Difficult things are inescapable. And if you want to pursue meaning and fulfillment in life, then navigate life as it is and learn the value of different seasons. Is that easy? No. That's kind of the thing with wisdom. Wisdom is not developed through ease. Wisdom is developed through difficult things, right? I want you to think about some different ways that this relates to the gospel. You know, verse 8, there's a time to love and a time to hate. That may seem strange. But in Luke 14:26, Jesus said, you cannot be my disciple unless you hate father, mother, brother, sister, yes, even your own life. It'd be difficult to figure out what does he mean by that? How do I balance that with his other teaching? But suffice it to say, for Jesus, there's a time to love, there's a time to hate. In Matthew chapter 7, verse 6, Jesus talked about loving your neighbor as yourself. He goes on to say, don't cast your pearls before swine. There's a time to embrace, there's a time to shun embracing, even according to Jesus' teaching on loving our neighbor as ourselves. Again, there's a time for every matter, and God makes everything beautiful in its time. I would encourage you just to think more about that, but we'll move on for the sake of time, verse 9 through 17. You know, again, as he's talking about life as it is and respecting what God has locked in and living in reality, part of what the preacher gets to here is a part of embracing what life is embracing our inadequacy and limitation and God's role. Look at verse 9 through 17. What advantage is there to the worker from that which he labors? You know, it's kind of the question of, okay, there's a time for everything, but when's the time to reap reward for all of our labor? Verse 10. I have seen the endeavor which God has given the sons of men with which to occupy themselves. He has made everything beautiful in its time. He has also set eternity in their hearts, yet so that man will not find out the work which God has done from beginning even to the end. I know that there is nothing better for them than to be glad and to do good in one's lifetime. Moreover, that every man who eats and drinks and sees good in all his labor, it is the gift of God. I know that everything God does will be forever. There is nothing to add to it. There is nothing to take from it. God is so worked that men should fear him. That which is has been already, and that which will be has already been. Yet God seeks what is pursued. Some translations will say what is past. Furthermore, I have seen under the sun that in the place of justice there is wickedness, and in the place of righteousness there is wickedness. I said in my heart, God will judge both the righteous and the wicked man, for a time for every matter and for every work is there. Again, very conclusive statements that he's going to keep circling back to throughout the book. But again, wisdom is rooted in navigating the realities of my limitations in view of God's nature. You know, verse 9, we may labor, but just because we labor and hope for fulfillment doesn't mean that our labor is fulfilling. You know, we may want to have a better understanding of eternity and God, but there's a sense where there's a limit to how much we're able to know. And verse 11, he has set eternity in man's heart. Kind of a confusing statement, you know, what does he mean? He set eternity in our hearts. I think it's the idea that this causes needful tension, right? We long for permanence. That's really the point of chapter 1 and 2, right? Vanity of vanities, everything is vanity, meaning it's fleeting. It vanishes so quickly. It's like oil falling through our fingers as we're trying to grasp it. You know, we long for permanence. We want joy to be permanent. We want relationships to be permanent. We want things that are fulfilling in a permanent way, not a fleeting way. But again, is this tension that this creates a good thing or a bad thing? Did you know that God causes problems so that we seek productive solutions? You know, that's even the gospel, right? God confronts us with the fact that we have a problem. The problem of our sin, ultimately, right? But God confronts us with that problem. God allows there to be that problem because there's a solution if we're willing to look for it, right? So having eternity in our hearts causes frustration. It causes kind of an awareness that there's a lot of broken things in life. You know, think about even verse 16. You know, we want justice. And yet what we often find and what I see people talking about on Facebook all the time, every day when I get on Facebook, is that in the place where there should be justice, there's wickedness. Chapter 4, he's going to mention this again, that it really bothers him to be confronted with the reality of oppression in this life. But again, that's a part of our broken reality. We want justice, but the reality is we can't really find true permanent justice here. The idea is we'll never be satisfied apart from heaven. Everything that satisfies us here in verse 12 and 13, she already said in chapter 2, verse 24, 25. Everything that satisfies us here just points to the satisfaction of heaven. Everything that we long for here just points to our need to be where there is permanence, which is not here. And in verse 17, even injustice has a time where it will be made right. Verse 9, our labor has a place of reward. It's just not here. God has given us a limited capacity, a limited perspective, but he's operated in a way in verse 14 so that we would fear him. God has designed life to be broken as it is now on purpose. God has designed us to have a limited ability and perspective on purpose. We can navigate that with wisdom, or we can be foolish about that. And then with that, God has made life to be beautiful and meaningful in verse 12 and 13, even to be joyful. I want you to turn just briefly here to chapter 11, which is not the last chapter, but something conclusive is said in chapter 11, verse 9. And I gave a sermon like 2 or 3 years ago just on these last verses of chapter 11. Chapter 11, verse 9, "Be glad, young man, during your childhood, and let your heart be merry during the days of your young manhood." Look back in verse 8, "Indeed, if a man should live many years, let him be glad in them all." You know, Ecclesiastes talks a lot about like the vexation of life, the frustration of life, the vanity of life. But did you know Ecclesiastes is a book that's meant to help us find real joy? What the preacher is doing is he's saying, there's a lot of joys we can pursue in the world that are just a mirage. Again, like drug addiction, where you take a drug, you feel an incredible high, it feels really good, but then there's a stark crash and a contrast between the high when you were on the drug and the crash that follows afterward. God has made us to desire joy and gladness and to seek to be content. But again, in verse 12, all of this comes from the hand of God. Verse 13, the gift of God. And I mentioned this at the end of the last lesson in chapter 2, where it says the same thing. Should the gifts God give us be used to forget him and reject him, or to pursue him? And is the gift itself the be-all and end-all of the relationship? So when he says, like, you know, to be glad, to see good in your labor, that's the gift of God. What I'm saying is that the preacher isn't saying that just to be glad, to be able to see good in your work. He's not saying that that being a gift from God, that doesn't mean that's the true, complete fulfillment of everything. Again, he'll say fearing God and keeping his commandments is man's all. But again, what he is saying is God's not trying to ruin our joy. God is not trying to get in the way of our joy. God is not trying to make our life miserable. What God is trying to do is help us live in reality as it is and have joy that is not vanity. Joy that is not fleeting and fake like a mirage. God is trying to help us have joy that is lasting and permanent and enduring. Again, Jesus said himself in John chapter 14, "These things I have said to you that my joy may be in you and that your joy may be made complete." If God created life, if God created us to be in his image, do you think he understands how to give us joy and fulfillment? What the preacher is saying is, we cannot find joy and fulfillment if we're looking for it apart from God. It can only be found with God. Let's go to the last section of the chapter, verse 18 through 22. "I said in my heart concerning the sons of men, God is testing them in order for them to see that they are but beasts. For the fate of the sons of men and the fate of beasts is the same fate for each of them. As one dies, so dies the other. And they all have the same breath. So there is no advantage for man over beast, for all is vanity. All go to the same place. All came from the dust, all return to the dust. Who knows that the breath of man ascends upward and the breath of the beast descends downward to the earth? I have seen that nothing is better than that a man should be glad in his works, for that is his portion. For who will bring him to see what will come after him?" So this might sound kind of like a strange kind of summary, a way to summarize this. But I would summarize this as what the preacher is saying is, wisdom is rooted in navigating what sets me apart from an animal and my lack of foresight, right? Again, God has locked some things in. There's aspects of life that cannot be changed, only navigated. And why do you think everything that Solomon just said right before this, that there is a time for God's judgment, that God will take everything into account, God will right every wrong? So Solomon's not just turning all of a sudden and saying, oh, and actually, never mind, we are just all animals and we should just live like animals. What he's ultimately saying is there's a tension here, right? Kind of like he's put eternity in our hearts and that creates good tension. We want fulfillment. We seek meaning. We want joy, But then under the sun, apart from God, it's all vain and shallow and fleeting. And so this goes for human identity. You know, so here we've kind of gone back under the sun and are just thinking about things from a very atheistic, natural perspective. In verse 18, what if we take God out of the equation? 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 12. So Peter is talking about false teachers, but he's talking about a method of enticement and temptation with false teaching, that it appeals to sensuality, natural desire, natural impulse. And here's what Peter said in chapter 2, verse 12. He said that these people are like unreasoning animals born as creatures of instinct to be captured and killed. Again, that sounds really harsh, but what Peter is saying, like, look, if we take God out of the equation, if what we're going to do is just live in a worldly way, then yes, we're just animals. And just like animals have no real effect on the world at large, animals just live and they die. What Solomon is saying is, if you take God's judgment out of the equation, if you take God out of the equation, we are just animals. But we know better than that. Again, why do we get bothered by injustice? Do animals get bothered by injustice? Do animals question their life's existence and search for greater meaning and fulfillment? No, animals just live on the basis of instinct, right? So why do we get so bothered by these things? Again, this creates a proper tension. God is creating a problem to instigate us to seek something better, something greater, something higher. There is an inescapable reality that, just like he said in verse 11, he said eternity in our hearts, we are made in God's image. There's no getting around that. There's no escaping it. There's no escaping the fact that God designed us to have a relationship with him. God designed us to be fulfilled by him. God designed us to live eternally with him, right? These are inescapable realities. And yet, here on earth, if we disregard all of those things, we're just animals. Again, wisdom thinking through that, that's a problem. There's something that makes us different than beasts that he's already divulged in the previous verses. And then where he gets to in verse 22 there at the end. We can't predict the future. You know, what he says earlier is, everything God does will be forever. God sees what we don't see. God anticipates what we can't anticipate. God is prepared for future realities that we do not foresee. You know, we don't know what tomorrow is going to bring. And so the inescapable reality is, how God has designed us under the sun is, we need to live by faith and hope. Because again, our perspective is limited. All we can do at the end of verse 17 is ultimately lean into the Lord to take care of things that are broken, injustices that are unresolved. You know, in verse 15, kind of strange statement, God seeks what is past or pursued, is just the idea that God is going to call everything into account. God's the one who sees everything. God's the one who's going to take care of everything. And so again, we have to navigate the reality of our limitations and learn to have wisdom with the scope of those limitations. This is literally what Jesus expounded on in Matthew chapter 6. You know, with over-investing, Jesus talked about not storing up treasures on earth because it's fleeting. Moth can eat. The wealth that we have can be lost, rust, and fade. We can't take it with us. He talks about not worrying about our lives because God is going to take care of our life. And then he finishes saying in Matthew 6:34, as he's been talking about faith and putting faith in the Lord, he mentions this: don't worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will worry about itself. Each day has enough trouble on its own. It's exactly what the preacher is saying. All Jesus is doing is taking the principles of Ecclesiastes and fulfilling it in the form of instruction. You know, verse 22, we don't know what's going to occur after us. We don't know what's going to occur tomorrow. And so what do we do with that? We strive for contentment, just like Matthew chapter 6. We seek God's kingdom first, and we strive to find joy in our relationship with the Lord. and that he's given us something that Solomon had no access to, that Jesus has made crystal clear, the reality of resurrection. Jesus has opened the doors to seeing into heaven itself by raising from the dead and ascending publicly to be seated at God's right hand. Jesus fulfilled all of the principles of Ecclesiastes 3, all of the conclusions, and the things that Jesus taught literally fulfill, point by point, the conclusions that the preacher arrives at in chapter 3. That's where we'll end the lesson. I commend the chapter to you. There's a lot in chapter 3, a lot of difficult statements, a lot of profound statements, verses 1 through 8. There's a lot to think about with the different seasons of life, and that everything in chapter 3, 1 through 8, everything in that list is good. It is beautiful. It is useful. It's just a matter of learning the wisdom to see it that way and navigate life in those different seasons. So what we'll do is we'll say a prayer for these things. And if there is any need that anyone has, any conviction that needs to be brought forward before the church here, anything that needs to be confessed or help to be sought from the church here, you can bring that forward after the prayer when we stand and sing.